A judge in a small rural county has entered an order blocking Illinois from enforcing its stay-at-home order on a Republican state legislator.
This is about local control and obeying the law.
This ruling has put the people of Illinois at risk.
We'll have the latest on what the decision means for Illinois' fight against COVID-19. Then, some states have embraced antibody testing as a way to figure out who might have already had the disease. But here in Illinois, Governor J.B. Pritzker has been much more cautious about the new technology. We'll talk to experts in the field. And Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, joins us for more on what it's like to do the Chicago-based quiz show without a live audience. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. The news is next. Stay with us. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Yesterday, a judge in Clay County, Illinois, population 13,184, issued a preliminary ruling in favor of a man who challenged the governor's stay-at-home order. The ruling means for now, State Representative Darren Bailey, a Republican from Xenia, cannot be bound by the governor's COVID orders. Here he is in a video posted to Facebook this morning.
It's obviously expected that as this, as my case pursues, when it reaches its endpoint, obviously what's good for me is good for everyone in Illinois. So that doesn't mean we reopen, that we go rampant and go to running around the state. Nothing at all is going to change for me. But, like I said, this is about local control and obeying the law that is already set in place versus what our governor chooses to do. That's what it's about.
But yesterday, as word of the ruling was coming out, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker did not hold back his criticism.
It's insulting, it's dangerous, and people's safety and health has now been put at risk. There may be people who contract coronavirus as a result of what Darren Bailey has done now.
Joining us now to talk about this is Amanda Vinicky. She's a correspondent for Chicago Tonight on PBS station WTTW. Amanda, thanks for coming back on the 21st.
Of course, it's my pleasure.
So who is State Representative Darren Bailey, and what was he trying to accomplish with his court filing?
Bailey is a freshman Republican member of the Illinois House. I believe he's a farmer. I think it's interesting to point out that he arrived at the Illinois House after ousting a former GOP lawmaker who he got mad at for having voted for the income tax increase that ended the budget stalemate. He won't be in the House much longer, not because he's leaving politics, but because he won a primary and has no Democratic challenger as he now seeks to represent the 55th district in the state Senate. So that's who Darren Bailey is. And what he was doing here is, he says, fighting for his freedoms, which he alleged were being trampled on by the continual stay-at-home orders, three now having been issued during the coronavirus pandemic by Governor J.B. Pritzker.
So what is in the judge's ruling? What does this mean for, let's start with, what does it mean for Darren Bailey?
What it means for Darren Bailey is that he's free to ignore the stay-at-home order, which requires everyone else to stay at home, barring any sort of need to take advantage of or be part of running an essential business. That said, Bailey, as you just heard there, says his life isn't going to change. He's not going to do anything differently with his newly granted freedoms. But nonetheless, he alone in Illinois will not have to comply with the stay-at-home orders per this judge's ruling. The judge's ruling, other than that, was really very short and limited to that.
And so what, I guess you've kind of answered my question, what does this mean for the rest of Illinois? Is anyone free to, you know, ignore the governor's orders at this point?
Definitely not. No, everybody still has to obey the stay-at-home orders. And if not, we have seen there have been here and there individuals who have been cited for, I believe it's reckless behavior, reckless conduct, if they don't comply, though that is something that the governor has said he doesn't want law enforcement to be doing a lot of. And he hopes that people, by and large, are doing this for their own good. But, and actually Bailey himself said that he doesn't want other individuals behavior to change. In an interview that I heard, he talked about his parents who are staying at home and he wants them to stay at home. He asserts that this is more of a local control issue. That said, Brian, it does sort of raise the specter. Will people see this news and say, hey, I don't want to comply? This individual doesn't have to. And also important to point out there that this is Bailey doing the suit as an individual, not as a member of the Illinois General Assembly. But will others seek to join? There's certainly downstate lawmakers who agree with Bailey. We're likewise at the courthouse applauding his endeavors and saying that they feel ignored by the governor. We're seeing sort of a regional divide where there are, again, legislators and residents, particularly in pockets of central and southern Illinois, who say that given the amount of cases that are coming out of the Chicago area, that there should be some regional changes. And Bailey is saying that that's what he wants. He wants that to be in the hands of local and county public health departments versus a statewide order.
You know, and let's talk a little bit about that, because obviously the coronavirus disease has been detected in almost every county statewide. I think the last count from the public health department was 96 out of the state's 102 counties. It's assumed to be everywhere because testing is still so limited. But as you say, most of the cases are concentrated in the Chicago region with smaller clusters, but still significant ones in downstate cities like Rockford and the Metro East, Quad Cities, Champaign, Springfield, Bloomington. But the rural areas have not seen these highest cases. Is this something that you think is going to, is this going to continue to grow, this sort of urban-rural divide that we're seeing on the response to this pandemic?
I mean, it's certainly not the first time that we have seen of this divide. Bailey, in fact, is one of the legislators who embraced and sponsored a measure that would effectively split the state in two, with Chicago being its own. So certainly the coronavirus is not the first sign that we have seen of this sort of regional division, nor is it the first sign of fatigue. I mean, in Chicago, there was a wedding party and then a house party where dozens of people got together despite the stay-at-home order. And there were social media videos flying everywhere of this party where people were gathering in very close proximity to one another, many not wearing masks. So I think both the fatigue of the stay-at-home order, particularly as the weather gets nicer, is a true challenge everywhere. Yeah, I think that this is going to continue to be a challenge. And it's one that clearly the governor has recognized. I also do want to say he has not been downstate in some time. And again, the bulk of the population is in Chicago, where he's holding these briefings and journalists from around the state do have an opportunity to ask questions because there's really only one pool reporter that is there. But I have heard back from some both lawmakers and residents that say, hey, wait, where is he? He doesn't know what is going on in my neck of the woods because he hasn't been here.
And briefly, very briefly, because we're almost out of time here, what is next in this case? I understand the Attorney General is weighing in this morning.
Yes, the Attorney General actually late on Monday night, so right away, hurried to appeal the case. And that has, it's again, a very short request, but they have requested that the appellate court of the Fifth Judicial District take this up immediately, seeking to reverse the opinion and to lift that temporary restraining order given to Representative Bailey.
Amanda Vinicky is a correspondent for Chicago Tonight from WTTW News. Amanda, thanks as always for speaking with me today.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Workers on the front lines of the pandemic often face risks just for showing up to work, whether that means caring for those who've contracted COVID-19 or ringing up groceries. And a New York Times analysis found that one in three jobs held by women has been designated as essential, and that women of color are more likely to be doing essential jobs than anyone else. Here to talk about this is Sharmili Majmudar. She's the Executive Vice President of Policy and Organizational Impact for Women Employed, an organization that advocates equity for women in the workplace. Sharmili, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian.
So what was your reaction to hearing about these statistics that I just cited?
I mean, these statistics are the reality that Women Employed has been aware of and advocating on behalf of since our inception. The fact that women are overrepresented in minimum wage, low wage work, and that much of that work is in the service industry of all kinds, and that work is essential. It's not just essential during a pandemic, but it's essential to our society and economy, and yet they're not treated as essential.
And that's what I wanted to ask you next, because I mean, this term it's not a term that I think a lot of us heard before the pandemic, this idea of essential jobs, but we're talking about nurses, home health aides, retail workers, and that a majority of these are held by women, and women of color are more likely to be doing these jobs. But are we paying the people who do these jobs like they're essential employees?
The simple answer is no. I think that with all of the call for treating these workers as heroes, the accolades that many of us have participated in on social media or in our communities, those are all deserving for these workers. But in reality, what these heroes need are livable wages, benefits, and protections, not just capes and accolades. If we truly think that essential workers are heroes, then we do have to show it by protecting them, by how we treat them, and how we compensate them. And, you know, I think one of the key ways that we can look at that in Illinois and in our nation is whether we do something as simple as providing paid sick leave. This is an issue that Women Employed has advocated on behalf of for many years. There is active legislation in front of the Illinois General Assembly that we're hoping they'll move on. And we've been collecting, you know, the input of Illinois folks from downstate, central Illinois, from Chicago, et cetera, who are overwhelmingly in favor of making sure that all workers have access to paid sick leave. But these essential workers that we're talking about are actually least likely to have access to paid sick leave. And I think, you know, as our understanding of pandemics and public health and all of that has evolved, we can really see, like, I want to make sure that my grocery store clerk has access to paid sick leave and is not put in a position where she has to decide between whether or not to put food on the table for her children or potentially go to work sick or not be able to take care of a sick elder or someone else at home, including herself. And so I think there's common sense policy that we can do that really benefits everyone that would truly honor how essential these workers are.
So your organization connects with working women to understand some of what they're facing in the workplace. What have you been hearing from people since the COVID-19 pandemic started?
Well, a lot of the people who have lost jobs are women. So I think we really have to understand that for women of color in particular, they're more likely to be primary or sole breadwinners for their families. So obviously this is hitting them very hard. But as you noted, the professions that a lot of these workers are in are face-to-face professions. They are not professions that can be done from home. And so people are really concerned about the risks that they're taking, the risks they're taking for themselves, the risks that then, you know, they're taking for their families. And these workers are also proud of the work that they're doing. They understand that it is contributing to our society's health and well-being and our ability to kind of continue functioning during this pandemic. And they just want to be taken care of, you know, in the way that they are trying to take care of us.
So after the pandemic is over, you mentioned a little bit about some of the policy changes that you would like to see people advocate for. I wonder, you know, what are some of the other solutions that you've seen maybe used elsewhere to help address some of these inequalities when it comes to women working in these essential jobs? And just, we have just about a minute and a half left here.
Sure. I mean, ultimately, I think as we emerge from this crisis, it's really an opportunity for us to evolve and build an inclusive economy that values the workers' well-being as well as society's well-being. And that includes everything from paid sick leave to paid family medical leave to ensuring that there are livable wages, but also ensuring that we have access to education and training because a lot of people will have lost their jobs and are going to be reentering the workforce and are going to need to make sure that they have access to skill building and educational opportunities. And we need to make sure the infrastructure to provide that is really strong as well. So there's lots of opportunities. There's a national coalition of organizations that is really focused around asking Congress, for example, to think about how women are bearing the brunt of the crisis and all of the things that we can do. It's called the We Demand More Coalition that Women Employed is part of. But overall, you know, we want to see Illinois kind of like move through this. As you were talking about in the earlier segment, you know, we've had three stay-at-home orders. What we do next is going to be really important on behalf of the workers who are most affected by this crisis, but on behalf of all of us. And we should really use that as an opportunity to not return to the status quo, but to do better.
Sharmili Majmudar is the Executive Vice President of Policy and Organizational Impact for Women Employed, an organization that advocates equity for women in the workforce. Sharmili, thanks so much for speaking with us today on the 21st.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Brian.
Coming up after the break, although some states have embraced antibody testing as a way to figure out who might already have COVID-19, there are still reasons to be cautious about the new technology. I'm Brian Mackey. More on that after this short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Earlier in the show, we mentioned that the number of people in Illinois who've tested positive for COVID-19, as of Tuesday morning, it's at 45,883. But the key word in there is tested positive. It's estimated that there are many more people who may carry the virus or who were infected in the past, but are not included in that official count. And that's why some states are testing residents for antibodies to see if they've been exposed at some point, or even if they never got sick. Researchers hope this will provide a better glimpse into how widespread COVID-19 is and when it began to circulate in communities across the U.S. New York has moved aggressively to do antibody testing. Here's New York Governor Andrew Cuomo speaking at a news conference last week.
But what we found so far is the statewide number is 13.9% tested positive for having the antibodies. What does that mean? It means these are people who were infected and who developed the antibodies to fight the infection. So they had the They were infected 3 weeks ago, right? 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago. But they had the virus, they developed the antibodies, and they are now, quote unquote, recovered. 13.9%, just about 14%.
That was New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Here in Illinois, though, the governor has taken a much more cautious approach to antibody testing. Governor J.B. Pritzker said at his news conference last Friday that antibody testing could give people a false sense of hope because the technology is not yet accurate enough. Joining us to talk more about what antibody testing can and cannot tell us is Christopher Byron Brook. He's a professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, specializes in infectious diseases. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Rock Island County Coroner and registered nurse Brian Gustafson. He suspects that the virus may have gone undetected for weeks in some areas of the U.S., including in his part of the state. Coroner, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be with you.
So, Professor Brook, I want to begin with you. What is an antibody test? How is that different from the test for COVID-19 we've been hearing so much about in the last month?
Right. So the normal test for COVID-19 is actually testing for the presence of the virus in the patient. It's a highly specific test, meaning that if you test positive with the molecular test, the odds are extremely high that you actually are infected by the virus. The antibody test tests for something different, which is really your body's response to the infection. And so it's looking for the presence of specific molecules that your body makes called antibodies that can bind to and inactivate virus particles, and that we typically start to make towards the tail end of an infection. And so, as was said earlier, the presence of these antibodies are a very good indicator that you were infected in the past. It's important to note that the positive signal for an antibody test is going to come up much later, typically after you've already had symptoms. So it's not really great for diagnosing infection. It's really something to tell you if you had it previously. But the one issue is that the tests for antibodies are much less accurate than the molecular test for the virus, meaning that if you test positive for antibodies, depending on which test is used, there is still a significant chance in some cases that you're not actually positive, that you're a false positive.
Hmm. So I'm trying to think of like the metaphor here. If I look outside and I see it's raining, okay, I can definitely tell it's raining. But if I look outside and the grass is wet, well, yes, it probably rained, but maybe the neighbor had his hose out or something like that. I mean, is that a reasonable metaphor here?
Yeah, sure. That's a good metaphor. And then the issue depends upon how frequently are your neighbors firing their sprinklers off. And yeah, That's kind of what we don't know in this situation. So in many circumstances, we don't know and this is true in Illinois, if the true positive rate, the percentage of people who really have been infected and really do have antibodies against this virus is higher than the false positive rate for many of the available tests, which can be as high as 10%. If you have a false, right.
Yeah, and so I was just going to ask, so I mean, what do we, are there antibody tests for other diseases like the seasonal flu? I mean, that we can, you know, that we can tell if somebody had that?
There are, and in some cases we have more accurate tests for other viruses that are more widely available, but that's because those viruses have been around for a long time. We've only been dealing with this virus for a few months. The other thing to keep in mind, though, is that the risks of a false positive for COVID, for anti-coronavirus antibodies are much higher than they are for influenza virus, because we're talking about using immune status or positive antibody tests to identify people who may be protected from the virus and may be protected from getting sick or transmitting to others. And so decisions are being made on that aren't really made based on influenza antibody status, for instance.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the reasons I think people seem eager for more widely available antibody testing is that it could help us piece together a timeline of when the virus was actually here in Illinois, in America. And I think initially the first reported death in the U.S. from COVID-19 was late February, but officials in Santa Clara County, California, have reported that two residents had actually died of the virus weeks earlier. I should say they've recently gone back and reported that in the first part of February. Do you have questions about when the virus may have come to Illinois or been circulating in the community? And I'll start with Professor Brook on that one.
Well, I agree. That's still an open question. I think a lot of people are working to develop a higher resolution answer to that question. One of the most powerful tools that we have is looking at the genome sequences of the viruses we have collected. That information allows us to estimate back when the virus was introduced into different regions and how long it's been circulating.
So, Brian Gustafson, the coroner for Rock Island County, I want to bring you into the conversation here. When was the first official death in Rock Island County from COVID-19?
Oh, gosh, I don't have that right in front of me, but it was probably 6 weeks ago.
6 weeks ago. But yeah. I think you have said that you suspect that, as we've just been talking about, that deaths were occurring earlier than we thought in the United States. And people have begun to question, you know, maybe the virus was circulating earlier than we initially thought. Maybe my loved one who got really sick could have had this virus. And Brian, you were quoted recently in the New York Times about this. When did you have that moment where you thought maybe this virus was in Rock Island County earlier than we knew?
Well, I didn't start to really think about it till late February. I personally became very, very ill in the very first part of January, to the point where I couldn't get out of bed for a week. I've never in my life been that sick. You know, looking back, as I look at some of the cases that I've worked up as far as individuals who have died, you know, November, maybe October, you know, I mean, most individuals who die from this coronavirus 19 have comorbidities. They have other disease processes also going on. Most of the time, the COVID-19 is simply the straw that broke the camel's back, if you will. Mm-hmm. But it's a very large straw, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, at beginning of the year at the best, I say even further, I wouldn't be afraid to say October.
Hmm. And so these are people that you, because they died from a respiratory illness, but now you're looking at their records and kind of thinking back, boy, I wonder if that could have been this other thing that was with the, you know, maybe we thought it was pneumonia, but in fact it was COVID-19.
And how much of a contributing factor could it or was it? Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. Professor Brook, could antibody testing tell us when a virus was in a community?
Not directly. It can tell you how widely spread a virus has been in a community, provided the testing is accurate. The exact time period at which the virus entered different communities across the United States is an open question. People are still trying to work out, you know, get better dates for this. I think it's important, and it's a natural instinct to wonder, you know, if I was sick last year, could it have been this? I think, you know, people are working to understand this. I think one of the tools that's been particularly useful or at least instructive is looking at how the expected death rates are elevated above what would normally be expected for a given year. Mm-hmm. Is one tool people are using, but it's tricky because, you know, this, you know, you talk about late 2019, that's the peak of influenza season. And that's another respiratory virus that kills thousands of people in the U.S. every year. So it's really hard to disentangle those two without specific molecular testing.
And Chris, I think many people who got really sick in the last couple of months, as we just heard from the coroner in Rock Island County, may have this same question on their mind. Maybe I was sick with COVID-19. And when we think about infection rates and pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic transmission, that's where people can transmit the disease without having the symptoms of it, a fever and cough. Do you think it's possible that more people may have been exposed than we know?
Oh, absolutely, for sure. There's no question that we're not testing enough to capture the totality of the infection burden in the United States. And the extent to which we're not capturing that is going to vary depending on the testing density in different places. So I guarantee you there are probably the majority of people who have been infected with the virus have not received a specific positive test result and, you know, probably haven't been tested. But how much that is, whether we're capturing half or 10%, remains an open question.
Yeah, and I wonder, we actually had a tweet from a listener, Nathaniel Fuente, about this, asking, you know, when people have recovered from the illness or seem to have recovered and then test positive again, I mean, are there limits to what antibody testing can tell us?
Right. Well, it's important to keep in mind the two different tests. So once you've developed an antibody response to this virus, this is still an open question as to how long it will persist, whether it's, you know, for years or maybe just a couple years. But at least over the time span that we've been dealing with COVID-19, once you have a true positive antibody response to this virus, we would expect that you would stay positive. There are reports of people testing positive via the molecular test for the virus after they've recovered, but there is no evidence whatsoever that those people actually have infectious virus. It's important to note that the molecular test for the virus detects a fragment of the viral genome. It does not detect biologically active virus particles. There's no evidence that people are getting reinfected with the virus or reactivating the virus later after recovering.
Okay. And that's what I was wondering. I mean, do we know if somebody has these antibodies, does that mean necessarily that they're going to be immune if they are re-exposed to the coronavirus?
Right. That's a great question. And it's one that no one has an absolute answer to. I think the normal expectation is that if you've recovered from this virus and you have an antibody response, that you will be protected to some extent, either that you can't be reinfected at all, or if you do get reinfected, it'll be extremely mild or asymptomatic. That's the expectation, but we don't yet have the hard data to show exactly what immunity to this virus looks like. What percentage of people who recover develop robust antibody responses, how protective those antibody responses are, and how long they'll last. Will you be protected for the rest of your life? Will you be protected for 10 years, 2 years, 6 months? These are all open questions.
Okay. And Brian Gustafson, the coroner in Rock Island County, I want to come back to you here. What questions would an antibody test answer for you, either personally or in your official role as a coroner? And do you personally plan to get tested?
Personally, I would love to know. Due to the nature of my work, I have an extreme potential to be exposed to the virus just by the nature of the work I do. I would love to know if I've been infected, if I have built up my own antibodies. I'd also like to know if the antibodies, assuming that I do have them, if I could help others who become so sick that they could possibly benefit from the therapy. So, you know, the numbers, as you indicated earlier, of confirmed cases are morbidly low. I mean, I think that as of yesterday, I think in Rock Island County, we only had 401 confirmed cases. I would believe that number to be much, much, much higher because we're not testing everybody. Me, when I was sick, I didn't even go to the hospital to get checked for influenza A, didn't go get checked for influenza B. I convinced myself I had the flu and I needed to stay home, stay away from people, stay hydrated, and you know, drink fluids and get better.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just I guess as we answer the questions today, we find that there are a lot of questions that still need to be answered.
Yeah,
we really don't know much about this yet.
Yeah, and Chris, that's actually my last question to you, and we only have about 30 seconds left, but what are the big questions that you still have about this virus and the way we are reacting to it?
Yeah, I think it would be a lot of the things that have already been touched upon. So how many people have truly been infected already? How long will people be immune to infection, to reinfection after they've been initially infected? I think those are the two of the biggest questions that would be extremely helpful to know.
Christopher Byron Brook is a professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He specializes in infectious diseases. We also spoke with Rock Island County Coroner Brian Gustafson. Thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up after the break, we're going to be talking to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me host Peter Sagal about the delicate act of striking the balance between news and comedy without a live audience. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you are a fan of NPR, you have likely heard this before.
I am Bill Curtis, and here is your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, everybody. Thank you all so much.
That, of course, is from the weekly NPR quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. For more than two decades, host Peter Sagal and dozens of panelists have taped the show in front of live audiences in Chicago and also across the country. But these days, you might have noticed that the show sounds a little different.
Here is your host, probably wearing pants, but no promises, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill, and thanks to our audience of the imagination. Although, honestly, after 5 weeks of this, I am starting to hallucinate that I can smell them. That, by the way, was canned applause from the opening night of Hamilton.
So for more on the quiz show and how host Peter Sagal is staying busy, I'd like to welcome the man himself. Peter Sagal, welcome to the 21st. Okay, we seem to be having a technical problem there, so we will ask you to stand by as we try to reconnect with Peter Sagal here on the 21st. Okay, I think we have Peter Sagal back with us now, so I will begin the introduction again. For more on the quiz show and how host Peter Sagal is staying busy, I'd like to welcome him to the 21st. Peter, thanks for coming on today.
Thank you, and this is why I don't live radio. Too much can go wrong.
The producers have written in here that I should say, forgive me, but I will not ask if you're wearing pants or not. I don't know if you got to hear, but it was the clip where Bill Curtis is speculating on that fact.
Yes.
I am curious. Are you wearing pants?
I am, in fact, wearing pants.
Okay, good to know.
I don't know if any of your listeners have ever come to see us live, but if you do, you know that even as radio, I dress up just a little. I always wear like slacks and a jacket and a shirt, sometimes a tie. And I feel like I need to do that because, you know, it's sort of my uniform for work. And
sure.
I'm not keeping to that, but I feel that the at-home quarantine equivalent is put on pants.
Yeah.
Just put on pants so you can approach your day with the requisite level of seriousness. So I am, in fact, wearing pants. No shoes, though. I'm not wearing shoes.
No shoes.
I'm wandering around barefoot.
I've found that it hurts my feet, but of course you're a runner and we can talk a little bit about that later. But, you know, I have been wearing a collared shirt to work, but shorts. That's
yeah.
kind of my
yeah.
coronavirus.
No, at this point, after, you know, at my age and after running so long, my feet are all callous all the way up to the ankle, so I feel nothing.
Okay. So for the past month or so, you and your colleagues have been doing Wait, Wait remotely. What is it like doing jokes without an audience?
Well, for us, it's a little nostalgic. Again, I can't speak to the experience of your listeners, but old school folk, OG Wait, Wait listeners might remember that when the show began, it was in a studio without an audience every week, quite intentionally. I don't know what the intent was. Well, actually, I do. The idea was that it would be easier to produce if we didn't have to fly people in, easier to edit if we were able to do it in studios. And it took us a ridiculously long while, if you ask me, to figure out that comedy shows should be done in front of audiences. People might laugh, and if they do, that's good. So we moved to doing live audiences as special occasions in the early 2000s and then permanently in 2015.
and have been doing it that way since then. So having to go back first to studios and now to our literal homes, our closets, is both very unusual but also weirdly familiar. It's sort of, I guess, the radio equivalent of being forced to move into your parents' home deep in middle age. I mean, you don't want to be there, but at least you know where the bathroom is.
Yeah. So is everybody using Zoom like the rest of us are?
Yeah,
for everything?
Technically, the way we do it is we all record ourselves. I've got one of these very nice high-def recorders, the same kind of thing that NPR reporters use when they're going out in the field to do interviews and such. And we record ourselves, but we talk to each other via Zoom. So we can still see each other, of course, you know, through the mediation of a screen and react to each other. And that sort of gets to the secret of how this is working, to the extent that it is, that without an audience to react to for them to react to us, we have to serve as each other's audience. We've talked about that quite explicitly, that we need to, even more than we usually do, listen to each other, react to each other, play off each other. Basically, I used to say to people when we did our show back in the olden times, i.e. 3 months ago, that every week we throw a big party and invite everybody to join via the radio. Well, we can't really, parties aren't allowed anymore. So instead, we are having a really wonderful conversation and hopefully, inviting people to join in that conversation, even if we can't necessarily hear them.
Yeah. You know, I've been thinking about this question of comedy without an audience, and you talked about how your show evolved to include the audience. Are you consuming the Colbert's, you know, at home
yes.
show? Some of these,
I am
John
absolutely.
Oliver? What do you think of their? You know, is it working for you without the audience? Have they found a rhythm?
And it's really interesting to watch, because I've watched it with a great degree of sympathy. One of the things we've discovered. When we lost our audience, and we did that quite literally, everything more or less changed on Wednesday, March 11th. That was the night when we went from "Is this going to happen?" to "Oh my God, it's happening!" And it just so happened that on March 12th, we were scheduled to do our show in the Fox Theater, a 4,500 seat theater in Atlanta, Georgia. And at the last minute, we let everybody know, "Please don't come. We can't have a large audience." And we did it on a stage facing 4,500 empty seats. So the sudden lack of an audience was quite vivid. And losing an audience, to quote the great Western philosopher Joni Mitchell, "You don't know what you've got till it's gone." And we'd always known that audiences were great because they laugh and it sounds like people are having fun, and that sounds like fun, and people enjoy themselves more when they hear it. What we didn't realize was how much we rely on an audience for not just laughter, but constant feedback. Mm-hmm. Are they enjoying themselves? Are they bored? Are they irritated? Do they want to hear more of this? Do they want to hear less of this? Are they being polite but wish you'd move on? Have you gone too far? Have you not gone far enough? You're constantly getting this feedback from an audience that you're not aware of until you lose it. So I have watched Colbert, and I've watched John Oliver, and I've watched Saturday Night Live and many of the others dealing with the same thing. It's really disconcerting at first, especially if it's just you reduced to looking into a camera, making jokes for people you can't hear or see. It's really, I can't recommend it. However, two things. First of all, we have an advantage. We have each other. We have a panel. We have a group of people who can be there for each other. And I also say that the other guys, our competitors in the space, are getting better at it. I think John Oliver in particular is really good at it. He's really good at like looking into the camera and talking just to you and trusting that you're interested and amused and are with him. Saturday Night Live, I think, got worlds better in their second attempt of an audience-less show than they did in their first. It's weird. It's just a matter of it's almost like Tinkerbell, where you have to clap and you bring Tinkerbell. You just have to believe in Tinkerbell. If you just believe enough that your audience is with you and are still enjoying you, even if you can't hear them, then you'll do great. It's that leap of faith, though, that's sometimes hard to do.
So as this crisis is continuing to evolve, we are all bombarded with news and information all the time. And your show has always brought people the news, but, you know, obviously not in the same way as other outlets. One recent example, you have a little clip here, but you actually had Tom Hanks back on Wait Wait to talk about his experience with the virus. Let's listen to that.
Now that you've had it, aren't you supposedly, like, immune? You're superheroes? You can walk amongst us and be immune, or is that just nonsense?
Well, a lot of the question is what now? You know, what do we do now? Is there something we can do? And in fact, we just found out that we do carry the antibodies.
Wait, so can we harvest your body? Can we harvest your blood?
Yes.
Have you been approached?
We have not only been approached, we have said, do you want our blood? Can we give plasma? And in fact, we will be giving it now to the places that hope to work on what I would like to call the Hank scene.
Yeah.
it's a great audience you've got there. So
yes,
we were just talking about antibody testing in a more serious segment before this one, but I wonder, can you talk about, do you feel any sort of responsibility, as so many of us do, you know, to focus on the coronavirus, to bring people news at this time, or is
it, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me put it this way. We feel a responsibility, but not inform people in the serious, frankly, that's your job. And it's the job of all of our colleagues at NPR News on All Things Considered and Morning Edition and Scott Simon and then the weekend shows. We see ourselves very much as in contrast to all the very serious and valuable stuff that serious people like you do. We exist to provide a kind of service, which is frankly a relief, or it's supposed to be a relief to people. You know, we've seen this happen before during very serious times. We've been around a long time, as you know, so our institutional memory goes back to 9/11. And so whenever something like this happens, something truly terrible and concerning and alarming, we see our role is to just give people a little break. Some of that is making jokes about very, very serious things. So we make jokes about the coronavirus, its various situations, the president's interesting responses. But we also just talk about other things. You know, we talk about just whatever goofy things we can find. And in fact, if there's really a problem, it's that not enough goofy stuff is happening. People talk about, you know, perhaps, you know, disruptions in our meat supply. That's bad. You know what's really a problem? Disruptions in the supply of goofy news. if you don't let people out of their house, they can't commit dumb crimes or pursue really silly scientific studies. And that's a crisis for us.
Yeah. So we've only got a couple of minutes left, but I want to shift gears a little bit. We have been talking on this show, as many of us are quarantining or at least just staying at home. People are pursuing new hobbies. You are an avid runner. You even wrote a whole book about it, The Incomplete Book of Running. I would tell people to go to the store and find it, but please don't go to the store and find it. Maybe you can look online.
No. Buy from your local independent bookstore. Many of them have online services. Please.
There you go. So I personally only run when chased, but with a lot of people looking for new hobbies, what is your elevator pitch for the sport?
My elevator pitch, here we go. Running is the most wonderful and perfect sport because almost anyone can do it if they're physically able. You need no courses. You need no lessons. You need no collaborators or teams. And you don't need equipment, just appropriate clothes and shoes. And if there's ever been a time when running is the solution to your problems, it's now. Why? It gets you out of the house. It gets you moving. It has health benefits. It's one of the few things that's allowed. But and to finish the elevator pitch on a much more serious note, we're all locked inside. We're all staring at screens or listening to podcasts or radio. We're all just sort of marinating in the crisis. Everybody needs to get outside. Everybody needs to move. Everybody needs to get out of their heads and into their bodies. And there is no better way to do that than just go for a run. Because why? You were born to do it.
And you...
Done.
An emphasis, and I'm not going to let you finish there, because an emphasis of your approach, I think, is no music, no podcasts. Get inside your own head as well as your own body.
Drives you crazy. I know. A lot of people are like, what do you mean? I can't endure my own thoughts for half an hour. And I'm like, dude, that's a problem. And the solution is not to continue to drown out your own thoughts. Your solution is to let them out. I can't tell you how, this is very personal, how relieving it is to let some of those thoughts come to the surface. Everybody is freaked out. Many people are very angry at their political leaders for doing something or failing to do something. Many people are very anxious. And the best way to deal with those thoughts is let them bubble up. Don't keep suppressing them with amusement or music or other people's thoughts. Let them come out. I can't tell you how many times I've gone for a run around my little suburb and, you know, delivered muttering under my breath, you know, incredibly devastating condemnations of like the people I don't like in the news or speeches I wish people were giving or whatever it may be. And then I come home and no one's the worse for wear because no one has heard it. I haven't jeopardized my family or career by saying this stuff out loud, but I feel better. And I can't, I recommend it to everybody. Everybody needs to let their own thoughts out. Otherwise, they're going to stay in there. They're going to go spoil. They're going to spoil. They're going to get moldy and start to smell.
Peter Sagal is a writer, a running philosopher, and host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Peter, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. And I hope everybody in your listening audience stays safe and sane. And I'll see everybody on the other side.
All right. Our show, and that is all the time we have for the 21st today. Our show is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpison's our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. I'm Brian Mackey. The show is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.